now. And fall they did. By the time our 3-hour deadline was up, we had received donations from more than 1 billion people. Stewart started buying, and the moment one person sold at a new, lower valuation, other investors got even more freaked out and he could buy at an even lower price. Altus's value crashed. He bought the entire Saudi sovereign fund's 10% stake for $4 billion, setting the value of the company at just $40 billion. After that, the rest of the investors would sell at any price. I texted April, "What did you do?" I wanted it to sound like maybe I was just curious. Maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought. Maybe it was temporary. There had to be a way to turn it off, right? April, "We're on our way home. Altus is broken. From what we can tell, there's no way to fix it. Spread the word. The investors will take any out we can give them." April, "But don't stop taking money. This was the world's decision. They need to feel invested." That was April. There was no truth but the optics. I was having a hard time believing that we were actually going to raise $20 billion, but it looked like we were going to beat the goal substantially. Here's a wild stat. If you distribute $1 billion across everyone in the U.S., each person would only get $3. That doesn't seem possible, but it works the other way too. Every person only has to give $3 for someone to have $1 billion. At 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time, Stuart Patrick texted me to let me know that we were down to our last $200 million, and we now owned a controlling interest in Altus Labs. It turned out we needed that $200 million, though, to pay severances to all of the Altus employees we laid off and to bribe the government of Valverde to prevent Peter Petrowicki from suing us. Eventually, Valverde kicked Peter off the island, and he had to go back to living in the California suburb where he grew up. It wasn't until he stopped that we could see the full scope of what Carl's brother had been doing. After we broke Altus, a full 2% of active social media accounts never posted again. That included the thread, but also a number of other similar YouTube channels. My theory is that Carl's brother was building audiences all over the internet and was planning to pit them against each other somehow. Or maybe he was just going to use them, turn them into his followers, and keep them perpetually satisfied. But he stopped, and that meant we had succeeded, I think. Whatever we were doing, we were on a path that didn't include us destroying ourselves or being taken over by a relentless, ever-present God AI. So Altus was gone. The threat had disappeared. April was back. Everything was perfect. And I was so goddamn angry. I did a pretty good job of ignoring my constant, smoldering frustration. But it was there, always grating on me, always waiting to be fed a little more fuel. I was so good at not looking at it that it took me a long time to figure out what it even was. I have some fiercely amazing friends, and I've tried to follow in their footsteps, but I'm not as smart as Miranda or as self-aware as April has become or as insightful as Maya has always been. Just for the moment, though, I'm going to try to be all of those things, even if I'm just pretending. I spent the time between April's death and the end of Altus trying out pretty much every way humans feel valuable. I got famous. I got rich. I was adored. I hung out with fancy folks. I helped people. I tried to change the world for the better. I made my friends laugh. I had powerful people tell me I was worthwhile. I wielded tremendous influence. I tried everything. So you'll excuse me if, at this point, I feel like enough of an expert to present you with Andy Skimp's simple list of the ways people feel valuable. 1. Just believing it. Sometimes this is religious, sometimes it is not. God cares for everyone, but society is supposed to as well. We strive to live in a world that places tremendous, even infinite value on a single human life. We do not live in that society, but I think part of the reason we strive for it is because we need to signal that our existence is intrinsically meaningful. This is the only source of meaning that does not rely on other people. It is also the hardest one to hold on to. 2. Story. We understand ourselves in complex ways. But oftentimes that can be distilled down into some core identities, and we imagine these identities as part of a story, and that story is some intrinsically positive thing. It might be being part of a tradition, or breaking free of one. It might be your race or height or hair color, your status as a child or a parent, being a job creator or a Star Wars fan or a snowboarder. We create positive narratives around these things, and when we fit in them, we feel like we matter. 3. Being appreciated. It might be hearing someone laugh at your joke, or being paid a living wage, or getting likes on Instagram. It might be only external, or it might also come from within. Appreciation is almost synonymous with value, and I think this is where most meaning comes from. 4. Helping people. This might sound the same as appreciation, but it's not. Indeed, I think your average wastewater treatment engineer will tell you that you can help a lot of people and not get a ton of thanks for it. But we are empathy machines, and one of the most lasting and true ways of finding meaning is to actually be of service. 5. Comparison. You know, keeping up with the Joneses. Also, every sport. But it's more than just comparing ourselves to other people. We also compare our current selves to our past selves, which is why getting better at something makes us feel valuable, even if we're the only ones who really understand how much we're improving. 6. Impacting the world. This one is simple, but so dangerous. If the world is different because you are in it, then you must matter. You must be important if things changed because you exist. But if that's what you believe, then the bigger the impact, the more you matter. And that can lead to some bad places. You might think that this list is too long or too short, and who knows, maybe it is. You might think that I missed a big one, like belonging. But I think belonging is just mutual appreciation of shared identity. It's like a feedback loop of appreciating someone for an identity you share, which makes you appreciate yourself. Also, these things are never felt in isolation from each other. A school teacher gains meaning from 1. Seeing the impact they have on their students. 2. Being part of the story of teaching. 3. Helping their students. 4. Being a better teacher this year than they were last year. 5. Being appreciated for their work, God willing. And I find that it is much easier to believe in your intrinsic value if you are getting all these other signals that you have value. I spent weeks working all of this out for a reason. I was mad and I wanted to know why. And now it's really obvious to me. Compared to my former self, I was just much less. I had gone from being a billionaire back to being just merely well off. April had taken my identity as her surrogate by existing again. The end of the thread had dramatically diminished my ability to impact the world. And on top of all that, I had spent months actually trying to help people, only to abandon that brand the moment something shinier came along. I was so mad. And I was mad that I was mad. And it didn't escape my notice that I was the only person being directly manipulated by both Carl and their brother. On the thread, one was working constantly to get me addicted to Altus and to get me to tie my identity to it. Carl, meanwhile, was betting that I would be able to overcome that temptation. Or, more likely, they were betting that it wouldn't matter. And if it hadn't, if it were up to me, I probably wouldn't have let Miranda break Altus. And that fact tore at me every day. This whole time, I was also dealing with the same Altus withdrawal that millions of people were dealing with. So basically, life sucked. And every day it became clearer and clearer that Altus was never coming back. And every day I got angrier and angrier about it. I didn't know whether to be mad at my friends for destroying it, at Carl for setting me up to fall in love with it, or at myself for being so easy to manipulate into loving something terrible. Over and over again, every night I kept my mouth shut. But then, finally, a couple of months after Altus shut down, I couldn't do it anymore. Andy. I'm mad. I've been mad the whole time. I can't stop. April. What? Andy. About Altus, I miss it. It's gone. I know you did what you had to do, but I'm still mad. April. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that, Andy. This made me even angrier, but maybe it was the right kind of anger. Maybe the fire couldn't go out until it burned up its fuel. Andy. Maybe I just need you to know. I thought we were going to get control of Altus, to do good things with it, not just destroy it. I don't know why we got to make this decision for so many people. April. Okay, I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm mad that you're mad because this is something that I don't know if I did right. But we had to do something. I wish I had your support, but I guess I understand if I don't. I didn't write back for a while. And then finally, a wall of text appeared. April. The problem with Altus wasn't how it was run or who was running it. It was that whoever was running it would instantly be too powerful. If someone had to be that powerful, you'd be close to the top of my list. We're good people, but I don't even trust us. Power concentrates naturally, but that concentration is, by itself, a problem. We made a choice for a lot of people, but that choice wasn't just, you can't have Altus anymore. It was, one tiny group of people will not be in charge of the future. We had to do it for Carl reasons, but even without that, it was the right thing. I really believe that. Altus was an invasion. They wanted to be the future. I think that was why they were so dangerous. The most impactful thing you can do with power is almost always to give it away. I read that paragraph several times before I wrote back. Andy. Did Maya help you write that? Because it's really good. April. Fuck you. April. And yes. Andy. I'm going to think about this. Thank you for dealing with me. April. Literally any time. I guess what I'm trying to say is, it's very important to have friends who are smarter than you, and who are also kind to you. I turned to Bex, who was lying on the bed beside me. Why didn't you give up on me? Shut up, Andy, she said. Go to sleep.
Miranda. So I saved the world, huh? I mean, not just me. But it's a little hard to feel like a complete phony when humanity would definitely have been doomed without you. That doesn't mean that I don't still sometimes feel like a fraud. But it's nice to have a solid touchstone. Also, I get to do really cool stuff now. I went back to Berkeley, where Professor Lundgren had, once again, kept my lab bench in place and available. And there she and I started doing something pretty dangerous and very secret. We took Altus's source code and tried to use it to figure out how it worked. What became clear pretty quickly was that no one at Altus had written the code. And indeed, no human had written it. Much of it was completely indecipherable. But that doesn't mean we didn't find anything useful. We were able to determine that the changes Carl made to our brains to allow us to receive and transmit data into their network were observable and permanent. And we were able to determine that even children born after the dream stopped happening had those changes. What we were not able to find was any trace of the computational system Carl's brother was, theoretically, still using to observe us. We knew it was there. But whatever systems Carl used to turn our biosphere into a planet-wide computer were too elegant for us to even perceive. You'd almost think it wasn't there, which I guess is the point. We all dropped our Altus nicknames when we got back to Berkeley. And I say we because the first people I hired onto my research team, yes, I had a research team now, were Paxton and Sid. I was trying to get them to go for runs with me, though they were more successful in getting me to play D&D with them. But I did succeed in getting them to help me do amazing research, We teased out the barest bits of how the Altus space worked. From that, we got little insights that could potentially help push brain-computer interfaces forward by 10 or even 15 years. And then, after we were fairly certain that we'd gotten most of the low-hanging fruit from our analysis of the alien code, you know what we did? We destroyed it. We took every single hard drive that had ever touched that stuff, and we put them in a truck, and we drove that truck to a facility that can smash anything into powder. And then each of us took turns throwing drives into the maw of this giant grinder that was built specifically to destroy hard drives. The drives split and bounced and ripped apart until they finally fell through to the other side, where they were nothing more than jangling pieces of plastic, silicon, and metal. We each took one little piece back to the lab with us, where they sit above our lab stations. Every day we come in and we do science. We do great science. And I actually feel like the leader of this little team. I feel like I belong to something again. We do it right, and we do it well. And in the morning, I come in, and I look at my little bent, mangled piece of hard drive and feel something lovely. I feel whatever feeling is the exact opposite of regret.
Maya. You don't get to know where April and I went. I've had enough of that. We're just here on planet Earth with the rest of the humans. Did we make a couple of not super well thought out financial decisions? Yeah. But we had to make a comfortable life for ourselves and Paulette. Paulette is our monkey. We did buy a house together. In general, I would suggest not having a very large shared asset with a girlfriend who has not always been the most stable person in your life. But I don't know. It felt a little like she had changed. Or maybe that's just my April-shaped blind spot. I think part of the point of loving someone is being able to deal with their brokenness. April's family was on the West Coast, and mine was on the East, so we compromised, and we live, well, somewhere in the middle. I'm going to save the memory of our shared reunion with our families for myself. It was the first time my parents met April's parents, and it was so normal that it could never feel as important as it was. It was not as big of a deal as saving the world, but it was close. Mostly, though, it was just the two of us. Time passed, and eventually, finally, it became clear that Tater was moving past its prime. We knew down there, somewhere in the darkness, there were treasures waiting for us. One morning, I declared it was time. April and I sank our hands into the pot together, feeling the little magically formed nuggets of food there. Our hands met under the soil, and we laughed together. And then April shouted with joy, "Paulette!" The monkey had popped one of the dirty taters straight into her mouth and was crunching it. We all laughed together, except for Paulette, who didn't like the flavor of uncooked potato and spat it out onto the ground. April's hands dug deeper into the pot to see if there were any other prizes to be found, and I just watched her. Her body, both new parts and old, working together to generate the tiny effort needed to push into the loose soil. She was beautiful. She had always been beautiful. Too beautiful for her own good. But now she was a literal technological marvel as well. I loved to watch her body. Her hand came out of the bucket holding something that was not a potato. With a look of complete abject amazement on her face, she held up a swollen and muddy book. She pushed it toward me, and I, on instinct, pushed it back. Honestly, I was a little terrified of what it might mean. "The Book of Good Times," it said on the cover. I moved over to kneel next to her so I could see the words as she read them out loud. "Hey, you two. I hope you get this. If you do, then things will have gone as well as could be expected. I'm sorry I didn't tell you more, but if you had known, you might not have succeeded. I've run a couple simulations, though, And in all of them, you forgave me at the end, so that is bittersweet. I'm sorry I'm going to leave you. I was never going to survive long anyway. I'm even sorrier about the pain I have caused. It has ripped at me to be the source of such conflict and division. I set that plan in motion before I cared about people as individuals. It was cruel of my parents to deprive me of that care, and then give it to me after there was nothing I could do to change my plans. But I suppose they did that for a reason. I just want you to know that you people are wonderful and beautiful and terrible and foolish. I was given knowledge of the action of other agents like myself and of the different kinds of people they worked with. Maybe it's reality or my own familiarity with you in particular or just my programming, but it seems clear to me. You are something special. I loved to watch you. I loved to learn about you. I loved loving you. You're radically collaborative, profoundly empathetic, and deeply communal. Everyone who tells you anything different is selling the fear that is the only thing that can break that nature. They do that because it turns people into devices. My only advice? Never do that to another person. And do not let anyone do it to you. Oh, and also, as a general rule, err on the side of caution. And she looked up at me and then kept reading. Listen to Maya. In this book are a couple of explanations of how I work for you to put in an eventual book that you will make available. It will be a memoir of our experiences in this time, and I would like to tell people more about me. I think it will be good for people to know what happened here, how I came to you, and telling the ones who will listen about my brother will further push you toward a more stable path. I hope you don't mind me saying so, but for you, knowing someone is watching does generally improve human behavior. I don't think we could have written this book if Carl hadn't said we would. But it was their last request, so we didn't have much choice. I can't tell you if you'll remain free. I can only tell you that you've got better odds now than you did before. I was very powerful, and losing that power has been very hard, literally painful sometimes. But other times, simply the knowledge of my own diminishment in the face of the greater power that now inhabits your planet was devastating. But my power was real. And while I'm angry at the loss, I do believe that my parents did know at least something about what they were doing. I believe that because I have witnessed my own power and compassion, and I assume that theirs is even greater. If you'll allow me one final trick, Maya, you two should probably go to Costco. Around 50 people will be coming over for dinner tonight. And so they did. Andy and Bex and Jason and Robin and Miranda all showed up. But so did a few familiar faces I didn't expect. My parents, for starters, and April's. But also, Sanvi Lagari, the woman who I interviewed about the dead dolphins, the two pilots who flew us to and from Altus, and Jessica and Mitty, our ambulance drivers. There were people we didn't know, too, like Miranda's advisor, Dr. Lundgren, and a bunch of people none of us had ever met. And every person there brought with them a small, simple, leather-bound book. These were the people who Carl had chosen. They were the people Carl needed to make the plan work. They were business owners and servers and nurses and drivers and teachers, and we connected with old friends and made new ones. It was Carl's last gift, and we drank of it deeply. We were awake until morning, laughing and talking about what we'd done and where we were going, and nothing seemed too heavy to carry, because all of these people could share the burden. But we also just talked about our friends and our hopes and our scars. And the soundtrack, of course, was perfect.
April. This isn't another cliffhanger, I promise. I'm done here. There's no more story left after these last pages that is in any way interesting. You want to know what a day in the life of April May is? I don't really care. You're convinced that I'm using my superpowers to affect the world in fiendish and clever ways? Well, I haven't been able to download information into my brain since Carl died, so that's not happening. You want advice for how to live in the 21st century and not have humanity taken over by a sinister force that, as you read this, lives on inside your very cells, deciding every moment whether or not we are past saving? I also would love to have that guidance. Unfortunately, I do not have it to give. That's the whole reason I wrote these books. That's why I wrangled my friends, racked my augmented brain, and suffered through the telling. Even in a world without Altus, the most sophisticated software in existence is tasked with figuring out how to keep you from leaving a website. That software knows all of your weaknesses. And while it's only concentrating on individuals, exploiting individual weakness is also exploiting societal weakness. What that software wants to do is make us into people who are easier to predict. These algorithms are already programming society. And the question that we now have to ask is, what happens when they realize it? What happens when one person or a small group of people, motivated primarily by the need to get their stock price to go up, realize that they have the power to program a society? What happens 30 or 50 years from now when the people who were inspired by the promise of the internet are all washed up or retired or dead? What happens when the stock prices stagnate and those companies need to demonstrate their worth to investors? What does a single CEO with the power to remake the world do? Do they help us overcome climate change? Do they help us progress toward a more just and stable society? Or do they just make money? Of course, I don't know if we'll be saved. I don't know if we'll get to keep going on our own path. And that's the kind of sickening thing. We'll never know. We didn't kill Carl's brother. We just convinced him he wasn't needed. He's still here, watching, calculating, learning, and ready at any moment to lead us carefully, subtly, secretly, and brutally into submission. And how do we avoid it? It might be that saving the world is idiotically simple. Maybe we just need to connect and care for one another. But I don't know. Of course I don't know. When it comes down to it, when has humanity ever known what it was doing? I was asked to become more than human, and I welcomed it. I wanted to be important. I wanted to be exceptional. But now my exceptionality is written on my face, and I cannot leave it behind. The fucked up thing is, when I look back at this, I may not have gotten what I deserved, but I got exactly what I wanted. Almost 6 months after Altus went down, when the world had mostly recovered from the anger and division that the loss had caused, and the economy finally seemed interested in some kind of positive movement, I woke up in my bed after having fallen asleep in Maya's arms, the same way I had dozens of times in those months. April, Maya said softly in my ear, this is going to be scary, but it's not something to be scared about. I was, of course, instantly anxious, but maybe out of a subconscious understanding of the situation, I didn't stir. Carl told me this would happen months ago, just before we left for Valverde. He said that if we made it through, eventually, and then she trailed off. I tried to shift, but my body felt wrong. Your arm and your legs, they are not actually permanently fused to you. You can take them off and put them back on. Last night while you were sleeping, they came off. I did panic a little bit then. I tried to lift my left arm, but it was not there. Instead, from my shoulder, a scarred and rippling stump stood out. I took my right arm to feel around my body, foreign and empty and small. Oh my God, I said. I drew back the sheet to look down at my body, soft and broken, and made only of human stuff. My face? I said, feeling it with my right hand. Carl said it can't come off. It's connected to your brain. So, I paused. It will always be in me. She crawled into the bed, and her arms and legs wrapped around me. I felt the prickle of her leg hairs on my skin. Yeah, it will always be in you, she said. But she didn't sound upset about it, just informative. I didn't cry because I was angry or scared or sad, though I was all of those things. I cried because it was just a lot. I might have also even been, in that moment, happy. For so long, I had believed what I had been told. That I was a tool, formed and sharpened and wielded for the world. Not a person, but an agent of change. A cultural mutagen. A weapon. I heard my breathing coming fast and shallow. It's real, I said. Because somehow, what we had done hadn't felt real until then. I hadn't felt real. I had lost myself. Not when I woke up in that bar, but 2 years ago when I woke up to a cup of coffee and a dozen text messages, and this same face looking down at me. I felt my story finally slide into place. It's real, I said again. It is, she said, and she pulled me into her. Your life is written on this body, and I love every piece of it. Somehow she made me feel human. And that is, I've learned, one of the very best things to be.
Hello, I'm Hank Green. I'm the author of A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor. And thanks, first, I should say, for listening to the audiobook. Audio is one of my very favorite story formats, and it's something I think a lot about when writing, and something that we spend a fair amount of time trying to get right. So I hope that we put together a good experience here. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot, and also using this story as a way of thinking about, are the parts of the internet that we actually live on. For me, this is different for everybody, but for me, that means the places where we create and connect. The social spaces that define our relationships oftentimes. They give us information that informs our values and our worldviews. And increasingly, those systems of community building and self-building happen online. And they happen, of course, in one of a few places. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, maybe a couple others. Really big corporations that have incentives that might not be ideal for us or for our society. Ultimately, like Facebook's chief incentive is to sell advertising. They want people to be on the site and to stay on it so they can be exposed to more ads. And if the best way to do that is to show them things that threaten their identity and outrage them, well, Facebook doesn't seem to mind that. This is a thing that concerns me a lot, that I think that we all need to think about a fair amount. So I wanted to end this audiobook with a special something just for y'all, just for audio listeners. It's the only place you can find it. I wanted to talk with somebody whose work was one of the doors to my more critical, more thoughtful understanding of the internet. Now, that doesn't mean I hate the internet or that I think it's bad, just that I think it's a really big deal, and it really affects society in really big ways, and so we need to be critical of it, and we need to be thoughtful about it. So Corey and I agree on a lot here, but we also disagree on some things. So if you want to go a little deeper into some of the main themes and things that I was trying to talk about in this book, here is a conversation between me and Corey Doctorow, author of Down and Out the Magic Kingdom, Little Brother, Makers, Homeland, Walk Away, and soon, it's coming out in October, so it depends on when you're listening to this, his new book, Attack Surface. So without further ado, here is a chat with me and Corey. Hello, Corey. Thank you for reading my book, and also thank you for saying kind things about it. I look up to you a lot, and I've really admired your work for a long time, and so I'm really happy to be talking to you about what I did here.
Well, the pleasure is very mutual. I enjoyed both your debut novel and this one, and I enjoy your work as well. And it was an honor to be asked to give you a little quote for your book.
Thanks. I've been trying to do a lot of things with this book, and I find this a really trying balance to be about the theme of the work and also about the plot of the work and also about the characters of the work. And you and I both do stuff that's pretty theme heavy. We're trying to say things about the world with our work. But like, we also don't want to sacrifice the reality of the characters and who they are, or the, you know, reader's experience of the plot and the fun that can be had. So that balancing act, before I wrote a novel, I had no idea what a problem that is to solve.
Yeah, so I had an epiphany about this. I was teaching on a writing program last year, and someone said, you know, a student I was doing a one-on-one with said, well, I know all these writing rules, like, you know, show, don't tell, and so on. Mm-hmm. And yet I read books I enjoy that break the rules. Some of your books break the rules. You like a lot of exposition and so on. When is it okay to break the rules? And, you know, there's a pat standard stupid answer to this, which is you have to know the rules to break the rules. I think that's completely wrong. I think the right answer is the rules are not things that you shouldn't do. They're things that are easy to get wrong. And so if you are like starting from the top of a manuscript that you're trying to improve, like statistically, if you start with the things that are hardest to get right and cut those out or give them critical attention, that's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. If I'd known that at the beginning, like my whole view of writing would have been different. I you know, this is like, I think I get one writing epiphany every 2 years, and this is the one right now.
Your most recent one.
Yeah.
When my brother, John Green, is obviously an accomplished writer, and so I've always been very nervous sharing my work with him. As we are recording this, he has read this book, and he has given me feedback, but I do not share the work with him until it is done. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear that from my brother. It's just too much, because there's like the brother thing, and then there's the author thing, and it's too much. But one thing he did say to me that was not about the work specifically was, your editor will almost always be right about the problem, and they will almost always be wrong about the solution. And that occurs to me, that's a sort of similar thing to what you're saying, which is like you can identify what's hard. And that's sort of what I'm looking for in a reader. Like, tell me what the hardest things are, the things that aren't working, and like, tell me your ideas for fixing them, but I know these characters better than anyone, and I know what I'm trying to do in this book better than anyone, so your solutions are 90% of the time not going to be the solutions I'm looking for.
Well, and I don't want to give the impression that you can't screw up the easy stuff too, right? There are, like, there is a verse-verse chorus version of plotting that I'm very fond of, where you just have a person in a place with a problem who tries intelligently to solve it, fails through no fault of their own, things get worse, you have higher stakes, you've got a new problem to solve, do that enough times, you reach a climax, and then it has a happy ending or a sad ending. You can get that wrong, right? Like, that part, that's actually like a really easy, stupid writing trick. You can get it wrong. My point is that if you're trying to make the book as successful as possible, the more difficult things you attempt, the harder it will be to make it successful. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not knowing the rules to break the rules. It's like knowing what's hard and what's easy.
So you've read this book, and so have the people listening. Can I ask you what you think the hardest thing was for me to do?
That's a superb question. And now I'm wondering how much of the silence the audio editors will leave in. You should leave it all in, including this. I'm going to say that having a likable character who has an epiphany about the ways in which they are unlikable and leaving them likable without making them unbelievable is hard. And it is, that's a turn in like a lot of great books, right? Like, I'm not going to say that, you know, this is not a uniquely Hank Greenian virtue or anything. That's a classic character journey, right? Is to figure out your flaws and overcome them. But it's hard to do because, you know, you have these characters who are very, very likable. You expose to us the card trick you played in book one, which is to make characters who are behaving sociopathically seem likable.
They're not, they don't seem likable. I think they're good people.
They are good people, but you make us like them despite their flaws.
Yeah.
And then you make us confront their flaws, right? You make us sit with them as they stare into the mirror and reflect on the people they hurt and the wrong they did. Mm-hmm. And then you have to redeem them again, right? And that, I think, is that's a hard trick well executed.
Thanks. Yeah, it is. And it is a something that I got a lot of feedback on, which makes sense. People saying, you know, initially, what I believe about epiphanies, and I think that this is like usually true. Usually you have the epiphany and 2 weeks later, you go back to your normal behavior. And in an early draft of An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, April had that arc where she had an epiphany. She knew what she had done to the people in her life. And then not long after, she went back to being as bad as she was. And the feedback I got was that while that might be realistic, it is unpleasant to read.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to talk about my work over much here, but I've got a book about to come out. We were discussing before we started recording, in which I take the beloved hero of my two most successful books and present him as the foil for his adversary, who points out all the ways in which he is horribly flawed. And the difference between he and her is that she knows all the ways she's flawed and he doesn't.
Mm.
And so they both have a redemption arc in it, but there is a kind of likability or at least respectability in knowing about your flaws and not pretending that they're not there. I mean, ideally, we would do something about them, but if you're not going to do something about them, at least don't pretend they're not there once you've had them pointed out to you.
Yeah. At least know they're there, even if you're not going to do anything about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that you are aware of and has been involved in the internet the whole dang time. And a lot of what I'm trying to do in my work is think critically about how media affects us, especially the media that we directly connect with, create, are inside of the media that is social, and what that looks like now and what it might look like in the future. And I am both excited and nervous about that. I know you have some really strong thoughts about that, but I was wondering if the book gave you any strong feelings about that world.
Well, I like the MacGuffin, right? That people are being manipulated through the media. And I'm not going to say that there's no such thing as media manipulation, both manipulation of the stories in the media and manipulated stories manipulating our beliefs and behavior. But I am also very mindful of the fact that every single person who's ever claimed to have had a mind control ray was a fraud. And
yeah,
big tech, they claim to have a mind control ray when they're talking to advertisers. They're like, you want to sell fridges, we'll sell your fridges for you.
Yep.
I just think that sales literature is probably not our most reliable source of information about how the platforms work.
I do think, however, that they do a very good job of keeping us on the platforms. And that is their primary goal. So selling refrigerators is the secondary goal, the thing that they do with the first thing that they do. The first thing that they do is they keep us engaged on the platform. They capture and hold our attention. They get us there. There's a subroutine running in my brain all the time that is like ready to suggest Twitter to me. And that has been very effectively created. And I've recently started using TikTok regularly, and never have I found a platform that created that subroutine faster. And not only that, but it's also Twitter and TikTok are both very good at encouraging me to make things and keeping me interested in making things and rewarding me in somewhat random but significant ways when I do make things, making me feel good, making me feel like people like it, sometimes showing my content to way more people than other times, but other times holding that back. So I never really know what's going to be successful when. All of that is like extremely, like exactly designed like a casino to keep me hooked. I think they are very good at that.
Casino is a really interesting metaphor. And obviously, lots of people have made that comparison, particularly, you know, the slot machine pull to the pull to refresh. Casinos are an interesting parallel because most of us don't get addicted to gambling. Right. So, like, I think a lot of us have had an initially compelling experience with gambling, where we go in and we put some money in the slot machine and we're not yet wise to its tricks. And we see that we got two of the fruit that we needed, but one in the middle, and that wasn't. And it was only one turn off from the one we should have gotten. Mm-hmm. Particularly with video slots, you get this a lot because it's just engineered to produce these near misses. Mm-hmm. And also you have, as you say, this intermittent reinforcement schedule on top of that. And you have a relatively high payout, right? I think, you know, you see in Vegas, the billboards say our slots pay out 98%, mm-hmm. right? Which, like, I've heard comedians do riffs about this, going like, if your bank said we'll give you back 98% of your money, you wouldn't put your money in there. But most of us, after a while, are like, oh, this isn't fun at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just done. And then some people, like, they buy adult diapers and liquidate their kids' college funds, mm-hmm. and they just stand there until they have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And so I think that some of us that for sure have like a pathological response to it. Like Michael J. Fox getting his first hit of speed in that episode of Family Ties, right? I think the median response regresses to the mean pretty quickly. And there is definitely an arms race where there's always the aggressiveness of the manipulation techniques have to keep going up and up. You know, in the same way that, like, if you look at the history of advertising, you know, you go back and you see warehouses that say, buy Pear soap, 5 cents, you will be clean. And then, like, 100 years later, it's like, Axe body spray will make you a love god. Mm-hmm. And presumably, 5 cents soap that you will be clean at one point moved a lot of soap, right? And it mm-hmm. doesn't anymore. And so I think that, like, we do become inured reasonably quickly. I think that's probably the crisis of most of these platforms and why so few of them had a second hit, right? Like Facebook is a one hit company. Google mm-hmm. is a 1.5 hit company. Mm-hmm. You know, Apple has actually made several products, as has Microsoft. The rest of them just buy companies that are successful, yep. right? Like they're not super geniuses who every time we deploy a countermeasure have something that trumps it. They're just people with huge war chests
right.
who buy anyone who lucks into a tactic that works against a countermeasure.
Yes, but they do that effectively, and they keep us on the platform. They keep us there, and I'm not thinking that Altus in this book is providing something that is like, it's not to control people's minds, except in as much as like it actually uses people to mine cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. That to me is more of the... sort of a very crude analogy of how our time is turned into money by these platforms. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. but the less crude analogy is that it provides an experience that is usually what we want to do, even if it isn't what we will enjoy doing.
Sure.
And we really do want to do it. I do anyway. And sometimes I do enjoy it. Like, that's the thing. But the thing to remember is that the platforms aren't doing any of the things that make it enjoyable, except creating the sort of mechanisms that make me desire to both consume and create. And
it's compelling without being pleasurable.
Right. And that is to me what Altus is good at. It is like, here is this other world. You don't have to be super worried about our world. You can be like super productive in time that you normally wouldn't use. This is something that like I was obsessed with, like that if you could give a bunch of guys the ability to like learn Spanish while they slept, they'd pay any amount for that.
Yep.
Because we want to be productive, yep. and like we want to hustle and we want to compete with each other. And even if that is always going to be like to some extent, like a pie that isn't getting any bigger, as a zero-sum game. And because it's a zero-sum game, people will push extra hard to be early on and early adopters and to use it even more than the rest of their cohort. To me, that seems like what social media is being exceptionally good at, especially as we start to realize maybe a lot of the currency of the future is going to be how good you are at interfacing with audiences and capturing attention, how many followers you get. Like, these things sound really kind of gross and subjective, but actually might end up being a lot of the currency of the future. And I think, like, you and I understand that because, like, part of why we make stuff on the internet is to get people continuing to pay attention to us.
Sure.
And so that we can just, like, have some slice of their attention.
So let me propose, or let me tease out something from what we just discussed here.
Mm-hmm.
If you stipulate that the tech platforms are not making things companies, they're buying things companies, right? That the way that they overcome this regression to the mean is just by buying the next thing and the next thing and the next.
Mm-hmm.
And if your concern is that once you attain inertia in Twitter, you then now everybody will pay attention to you because you have a lot of followers, and then you'll get more followers because everyone's paying attention to you, then both of these things have the same remedy, which is to return to a pretty recent version of American corporate law, the antitrust law that predates Ronald Reagan, that prohibited yeah. companies from buying nascent competitors, right? Where yeah. companies were really only allowed to grow through innovation. And that was when you had companies like AT&T making Unix, even though they didn't know what to do with it. And mm-hmm. you had Xerox, you know, starting Park and inventing the graphical user interface, even though they didn't know what to do with it. You just had all these companies that had to throw money at basic R&D. And still they were like, one was toppled after the other. You know, like I have been in the Googleplex when it was the Silicon Graphics headquarters. Right. I remember these giants who have been buried mm-hmm. beneath the foundations of our current giants. And the only thing that's different about them is not the venality or the ambition. It's mm-hmm. the legal regime that allows them to realize that venal ambition. So mm-hmm. do we not just solve this by like forcing Facebook to have the reckoning that it dealt to MySpace rather than allowing it mm-hmm. to buy every company that might do to it that what it did to MySpace?
In my world, in the world I would like to have, not only should you do that, but you should also force Instagram and Facebook to not be in the same company. You should force YouTube yep. and Google to not be the same company. Amazon's website should be a different company than Amazon's fulfillment network, which should be a different company from Amazon Web Services. Like, there should be a lot of breakup happening. And also, yes, you should not be able to buy a competitor either to just put it out of business, which happens,
yep.
or to you know, to sort of like make it into Instagram, which is now like a lot of Facebook's value. So I think we have two paths forward. Either that one, where we actually take antitrust seriously and we say these are going to be companies and we need to treat them like companies and we need to not let them amass the amount of power they are amassing. Google has more lobbyists than I think anybody else. Mm-hmm. But also, like, they have a tremendous amount of power over us, like, and over society. They have a lot of impacts, like how the YouTube recommendation algorithm works has demonstrable impacts on society. Or the other alternative, I really think, is that those companies, and Altus is my version of this, they aren't companies anymore. They are like countries. They have borders, they have monetary policy, they have laws, and they have law enforcement. Like, already these companies look a lot like countries to me, and we look a lot less like customers and a lot more like citizens. And that's why they don't use the word customer. They use the word user, which mm-hmm. is a new word in the world of business. But to me, that word should be interpreted as, whenever I hear that word now, I want to think citizen. I want to think you are a government run by a lifetime appointed young man, Facebook, as an example, who, along with a very small group of people, makes decisions that affect literally billions of people, literally everyone on the planet, but directly 2.6 billion regular users.
So I hear what you're saying. You're right. I mean, I think that the problem with Facebook is not that the wrong person is in charge of the social lives of 2.6 billion people.
I totally agree. I totally yeah. agree with you. I agree that it is a person. And like, for example, I have really great relationships with a lot of the top people at YouTube. I think that they're good sure. people. And I think that like they really care and are trying to do yep. the right thing. I think it's too much power consolidated in one place with no checks and no balances.
I totally agree. But what I want to say is that I don't think that the scale that you're talking about is unprecedented. I actually think we have a direct precedent in the era of trust busting. So, you know, look at Mellon as in Carnegie Mellon, right? Who was mm-hmm. the Secretary of the Treasury and also owned Alcoa, which owned all of the aluminum in the world. They said that mm-hmm. he owned an element. Right. He got the U.S. government to enter into trade agreements with Colombia that got his company the franchise for all of the aluminum in Colombia. Right. He withheld aluminum from the aerospace industry during the war so that he could keep the price up. Mm-hmm. Right. They were sending home aviation workers in the middle of the day because they had to shut down the plant. because the Secretary of the Treasury wouldn't sell them aluminum. Right. So like, yeah, mm-hmm. we have had monopolists who were countries before, as powerful as countries, more powerful than countries. But, you know, we broke them up. And like, there is a thing that happens in our normative discussion about these companies where the tide turns like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mellon appointed the oversight panel that broke up Alcoa. Right. Like, it was his own handpicked appointees a few years later who turned around and were like, mm-hmm. no, I'm sorry, that's not permissible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can make the easy case, the difference for me is that I don't live in aluminum, whereas I do live on the social internet. Like, this is a space that I inhabit. It's a place I pay taxes, even. Like, I make money on YouTube, and I give YouTube 45% of that revenue in order to provide right. me with physical infrastructure and also, you know, non-physical infrastructure. And when that breaks, it's very similar to like a water main breaking or the power going down in my town. Like, I can't do my business. Their platforms, and in that way, we live there. You know, they say in their names that they are social. They are by their names and their nature is social platforms. It is where we spend our times. It is how we have social interactions. It is how we run our businesses. And part of the reason that they are good places to run businesses is because they have this tremendous network effect where there are so many eyeballs. Like, the reason YouTubers don't leave YouTube isn't because they have the best video platform, though it is fine. It's because that's where all the eyeballs are.
Right.
And the reason all the eyeballs are there is because that's where all the creators are. But the reason all the creators are there is because that's where all the eyeballs are. It's a very difficult thing to recreate, especially in a world where there's always someone ready to take your spot. So if I leave YouTube, it's not like anybody gets hurt by that.
Right.
You know, there's always someone younger and hungrier and more talented and better than me who's ready to fill whatever niche gets left behind.
Well, you are definitely right that tech is not the same as aluminum. Although there's a part of me that wants to like do a film reel announcer and say, but Hank, have you ever considered what your life would be like without aluminum? But, you know.
Yeah.
That said, you know, tech is different. And one of the ways in which tech is different, I'm not much of a tech exceptionalist, but this is one way in which I am a tech exceptionalist. The general purpose character of tech, right? The fact that like all computers are at this computer science level, functionally equivalent, they can all run the same programs, mm-hmm. that the internet handles all data the same way. Those general purpose natures of technology means that network effects are a lot less salient, right? Like if you own all the railroad tracks, mm-hmm. as the rail barons did, mm-hmm. someone can't just come along and start running trains on your tracks.
Yep.
But if you are all of the websites in the world, Google can come and scrape all the websites and index them,
mm-hmm.
right? If you are MySpace and have all of the social media users in the world inside your walled garden, Facebook can make a tool for users who want Facebook's superior user experience but still want to talk to their MySpace friends, mm-hmm. that logs into MySpace on their behalf, grabs their waiting MySpace messages, puts them in their Facebook inbox, lets them reply to them, and pushes them back out to the MySpace users' inboxes with a footer that says, why aren't you on Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So those are things that we used to have. It's got a terrible mouthful of marbles name. It's called adversarial interoperability. And
I think it might be against a lot of terms of service, but that, you know.
So the terms of service didn't used to be enforceable. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was passed by Congress after Ronald Reagan freaked out after seeing Matthew Broderick in War Games, true story, was later reinterpreted by companies like Facebook that paid fantastic amounts of money for lawyers to argue these very expansive versions of the CFAA that banned violating terms of service, actually criminalized it, made it into a felony. And that's already starting to change back. There's a company called HiQ that was scraping LinkedIn and violating their terms of service, mm-hmm. and LinkedIn unsuccessfully sued them. And the court actually ordered Microsoft, who owned LinkedIn, to stop interfering with their scraping. Mm. So, you know, we can restore the freedoms that allowed new market mm-hmm. entrants mm-hmm. to disrupt these tech companies. I mean, they love disruption, just not when it's happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can vest them with state-like duties, right? You know, we can make ourselves citizens and we can say you have to treat us in certain ways, which include things like policing harassment and policing copyright infringement and getting terrorist beheading videos off the platform within 1 hour, as they've just said in Europe. And if we do the latter, we preclude the former. because the latter only works if you have total control over the platform.
And I mean, this is the argument, though, because if you don't have total control over the platform, I know that you're going to disagree with this, but the scale of the problem is very big. The scale of harassment is very big. The scale of harmful videos or misinformation is very big. And so do you need commensurately big organizations to handle those problems? Does making that fragmented and all over the place make it so that you have a lot of small companies that cannot handle those problems, and you have places that sort of like pop up as like, this is the area where it's kind of okay to have that stuff that's actually really harmful. Mm-hmm. And this is the place where you can go and feel like that place doesn't exist.
Well, you know what? If you stipulate that the tech companies will eventually solve the harassment problem, then you're right, right? If someday they figure out how to moderate 2.6 billion people's social lives well,
yeah,
then this would indeed undermine it. If you are like not ready to believe that that is on our horizon anytime soon, then what we're really saying is all of you people who are being harassed, mm-hmm, you have no recourse to self-help measures, nor can you seek a rival to help you get a better experience out of the dominant platform. Yours is but to bide your time and hope that eventually Zuckerberg gets around to it, or, mm-hmm, or Jack or whoever. So I have a colleague, my friend Cecil Castellucci. She's this amazing multi-threat writer, musician. She wrote, mm-hmm, a hockey opera that has a Zamboni machine in it. She writes these great YA novels, and she's currently writing Batgirl for Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And as a woman writing comics, she attracts the worst men on the internet who want to tell her that women shouldn't write comics and also, mm-hmm, women should shut up and get off the internet. And they have a method, which is to send you a direct message on Twitter that's horrible and offensive and threatening, and then immediately, mm-hmm, delete it once they see the read receipt.
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter, to its credit, will not accept screenshots of harassment as evidence of harassment because harassers would forge screenshots, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Nor, to their credit, can they recover deleted direct messages readily, which is great because that means that if your friend gets arrested at a Black Lives Matter demonstration, you can delete the DMs you put in their inbox before, mm-hmm, the cops search their phone, and the cops can't order Twitter to produce those messages. But what that means is that when these men then go and post in the public timeline messages that are themselves not violations of Twitter's terms of service, but which harken back to, mm-hmm, this deleted message, mm-hmm, they can re-traumatize their victims over and over again with total impunity. Now imagine if you could just make another service that sucked in waiting Twitter messages and pushed out Twitter messages. You could, with the half dozen other friends who are similarly situated, that being the total number of women who are prominently writing comics today, because that's where Marvel and DC are at, right? Mm-hmm. You could, with that small group of harassed women, have your own house rules about what constitutes a bannable offense, what is evidence of trolling, and so on. And you could enforce those at the gateway between your service and Twitter. So you could still be in the discourse,
mm-hmm,
but not have to wait for Twitter's forbearance or generosity to address your tiny edge case of the 12 women who were harassed by the 100 men who figured, mm-hmm, out the method to be bad on Twitter.
Yes. What I will say to all of this is that both investors and companies love their moats. They love to be monopolies. And it's going to be very hard to have them not be monopolies. And I think that we very well may end up in a world where we have to imagine ourselves as these citizens of platforms and just accept that we live in a world where, like, we are half citizens of a democracy, however flawed, and half citizens of these, you know, corporate autocracies that very deeply affect our lives because they are places where we live substantial portions of our lives.
Yeah. I mean, I love the internet, right? I actually do love the internet. It's no longer fashionable to say that. I still really love the internet. It's where all my stuff is. It's where all my friends are. It's where all, yeah, the good things in my life happen,
mm-hmm,
right? It's just where a lot of really, really bad things happen. And I enjoy configurability, right? It's nice to have a service or, mm-hmm, or a product that has some intelligent defaults. But, you know, on average, every one of us is weird. Right. Like when they first started to do statistically average measurements for army uniforms, mm-hmm, and they made the army uniform that fit the statistically average person, it fit nobody.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, configurability, we talk about it a lot in these cases where there's no ambiguity about whether people should have it. Like, should blind people be able to bolt a screen reader onto the text that the internet presents to them? No one's going to say, yeah, fuck you, you're blind, right?
Yeah.
But that configurability extends all the way down. You know, speaking as someone who's like low contrast vision is all but gone. The tools that exist in my operating system for people who are legally blind to radically increase the contrast and size of text are what make much of the world's culture still accessible to me. And incidentally, if you're a designer listening to this and you are setting any type that is gray on white, you're a bad person and you should be ashamed of yourself. I think that what's missing is not thoughtfully designed services that people who care about their users spend a lot of time figuring out how to get right. I think what's missing is the ability of users at the edge to take those choices that were made and modify them for themselves. And, you know, when we talk about like automated enforcement, we're really talking about this issue. You know, when we talk about like, say, license plate cameras that automatically hand down a ticket if you're going 1 mile an hour over the speed limit, there's times when you should, right? There's times where like human judgment demands that you speed or that you, you know, do something else that isn't strictly legal, right? You have the intelligence at the coalface to make those choices. And the problem with robotic enforcement, the problem with the like, I can't let you do that, Dave, school of product design, is that no designer before the product ships can anticipate all the ways that a user will need to use it. And you know what? Now I want to write a scene in which someone is like in a tense hacker movie, you know, about to like save the world. And then the operating system throws up a dialogue that says, you need to reboot now. I've updated in the background for you. And the world ends.
We are at the mercy of our tools, Corey.
You know, there's a reason that like every farm has a forge and a workshop, right? Like, you know, it's fine to get the very best of the tools that there are, but eventually you have to make it suit your hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And also things will break. And if you can't fix them, then you are reliant on someone else to fix them for you.
Oh yeah. I mean, my whole philosophy of life is that it's way more important to pay attention to how things fail than how they work.
Right. Well, and I think that like, we don't do a terrible job of that. I think that we, you know, we pay attention to the problems. Like, I think that that's a human nature thing. And I agree with you. I do love the internet, and I think that it is great. I think that it has done a tremendous amount of good and continues to do a lot of good. I think it's very difficult to argue against that. But I think that we do need to pay a lot of attention to how things are breaking. And I think regardless of whether we are citizens of corporate states, we are citizens and need to take our role as citizens of the internet seriously by, you know, being media literate, by knowing when to post something and when to stay your hand, by knowing when you're being motivated by only outrage and also, or when you're being motivated by productive outrage, like understanding what is fueling us and understanding the direction that our car is pointing in. I think you have to have both of those things in mind as you are acting in public spaces. And we are still learning how to do that. And we are also still being provided with all the right tools that will allow us to do it most effectively.
You'll get no argument from me on that. I want to say something else that really resonated with me about the book and this thing that we're talking about, this compulsive use. So I have long struggled with chronic pain. And one of the most effective ways for me to escape chronic pain is to work. However, one of the most dreadful ways to exacerbate my chronic pain is to sit in front of my computer working. And there are many places in our lives and many, many relationships and patterns in our lives where the thing that delivers us a short-term benefit delivers a long-term harm. And it seems like one of the things that this book is trying to reckon with is that in respect of our civilizational conversation.
I appreciate you for saying that. And I think that that's a really big question. And I also think that it is, you know, people often ask me how I am optimistic, because I think I put that out into the world, a fairly like pro-human perspective. And if you look at the news, it can be hard to have that perspective. But one, I look at what we've done, the problems that we've solved so far. Of course, most of them have created new problems, but that's the nature of any engineering. I'm pretty impressed by humans on the whole, but I think that sometimes problems get solved by slowing way the frick down. And to some extent, that's what this book is about. I think we are moving very, very fast, and I wouldn't mind slowing down a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that seems to be the motif of the last decade, right? That, you know, and I understand that things that can feel dynamic and exciting when you're 25 can feel, you know, paralyzing and exhausting when you're 45. I have a long running gentle, haha, only serious discussion with Werner Vinge, who popularized the term the singularity, where I'm like, so how much is the singularity is the belief that technology will outstrip our ability to understand it? And how much of it is like, the feeling by a distinguished eminent technologist like you that when the day comes that you don't understand technology, the problem isn't you, it's that technology is literally just no longer comprehensible by anyone.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I think to some extent we are already in a world where people don't understand. Because, well, the thing that is ununderstandable about technology right now isn't the technology. It's about human interfaces with technology. So we have this idea that there's like these algorithms out there and the algorithms are like doing things. But every input into an algorithm is a human decision. And social media algorithms take human decisions and they figure out how to, like, what conditions result in the outcomes that they want. And they seek out those conditions and then they duplicate them. And what we're not understanding in that situation isn't machine learning. It's human decision-making. Mm-hmm. And human decision-making turns out is extremely complex and also has lots of unintended consequences and is full of bias and terrible instincts and lots of ways in which we are happy to consume content that we hate and that does not benefit us in any way. And so the algorithm will continue giving that to us. And I think it can be societally destructive. Mm. You know, there's this thing, this is a well-known sort of YouTube thing where if you like a creator a lot, it will feature content that is about that creator that gets a lot of clicks. And that content is always, actually, this creator is bad. And so there's this really common thing where you'll be watching a YouTube video from somebody and you're like, I like this. And then there's a thumbnail over on the side and it's like, this person sucks. And you're like, well, I'm curious, why does this person suck? And then it's like a, you know, really hackneyed, decontextualized hit piece. And that... Right. That kind of content is very successful and has been. This is not just a YouTube problem. And that's a human instinct. It is not something that the YouTube algorithm is doing. It is something that people are doing. They're feeding it that information that people will click on that if they see it.
Sure. I mean, mind control rays are hard, but making people angry is actually pretty straightforward. you know, Dana Boyd has got this riff she does about how if you type climate hoax into Google, and then if you type climate emergency into Google, you're talking about the same subject and Google will give you different results for reasons that are totally obvious to any of us, right? Words that contain, you know, pages that are highly ranked for one phrase will have a very different point of view to the other. And, you know, we talk about algorithmic polarization and what have you. If you're a machine learning system and you are asked, what is it that makes people sort of hate read the internet, happening on this relationship that people who are, you know, all of their consumption is about how great Hank Green is, that if you show them something that has the word Hank Green and sucks in close proximity, that they will then rage read it. That is, you know, like that is not an incredible magic trick. Right? Like nobody's doing a Vegas mental act here.
No.
They have done the world's most simple way of ginning up a certain behavior. And I am skeptical that tech can make us buy refrigerators. I'm actually pretty sanguine with the idea that tech can make many of us angry much of the time. I don't think that's hard to do. It's the guy who runs Slate Star Codex, who's a pseudonymous blogger, he calls it sort by controversial. Sort by controversial is pretty straightforward.
Yes. But also I feel like it should be pretty straightforward to be able to avoid. And yet they don't seem to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is where Eli Pariser, you know, was so right and so wrong. He wrote The Filter Bubble. Mm-hmm. And his prediction was that we would have algorithms that would only show us things that we agree with. And it turns out that algorithms can figure out which stuff we would agree with, but that we don't engage with it very much. Yeah. And that mostly what they show us is things that we don't agree with.
They show us the worst examples of the people who disagree with us. Like, this is going to make me most angry and feel best about myself. Show me that. And so instead, like, it's really like never before have we been so exposed to dissenting points of view. It's just that we don't like them. And also we are being shown the dissenting points of view that are most extreme and most confrontational.
Well, and
stupidest.
If you think about what Facebook is really good at, it's really good at finding people with hard to find traits. And that's why we love it, right? People I mm-hmm. went to high school with in a city I mm-hmm. don't live in anymore is mm-hmm. a hard to locate trait on the internet. Mm-hmm. Facebook will show you those people. But, you know, there's a reason that we stopped talking to the people we went to high school with that we no longer live in the same city as, and that's that we don't have much to talk about. And so if Facebook mm-hmm. is going to generate enough clicks to occasionally consummate the refrigerator ad with someone who wants to buy a refrigerator, they have to find a way to get you to talk about something, and you've got nothing to talk about. But if, you know, Facebook non-consensually promotes, you know, Donald Trump headlines to the top of your, you know, class of 86 Cougars group, you will all argue about Trump. And then, you know, every now and again, it'll show a refrigerator ad to someone who wants to buy a refrigerator and Facebook will earn a commission.
I have so much faith, and we're going to end this conversation soon. I have so much faith in our ability to, at some point, solve this problem in, or interface at least with these problems in productive ways. I still don't really know what it looks like, but the point I was trying to get at with the book and the optimism that I have is that it's going to require a lot of people working together, recognizing the same problem. That's really hard, but I think that we get there. And I've seen examples of us getting there in my lifetime. And so I know it is possible.
I think you're right. I think that we grossly underestimate how quickly and comprehensively we have normative shifts. And it's only when we go back and look at our public statuary and what its context is, or what's in our literary canon, or whatever, they go, or you know, like what's in our reruns, right? When we go back and we get those DVDs of the Warner Brothers cartoons that Whoopi Goldberg introduces with a solemn 5 minutes about, like, guys, mm-hmm. you're going to see some stuff here that you might have liked when you were seven, and it's going to freak you out. You know, that's when we realize how comprehensively our norms can shift.
Yeah. Yeah. And I it's very difficult to see in the moment and then very easy to see in retrospect. So I'm looking forward to 10 years from now when I can look back at this book and see what I got wrong, what I got right, and what humanity got right.
Well, I am looking forward to having a drink with you in 10 years and talking about the book.
All right. Sounds absolutely fantastic. Thank you, Corey.
Thanks, Hank.
This is Kristen C. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor by Hank Green. This audiobook featured performances by Kristen C. as April May, Joe Hempel as Andy, Jesse Walensky as Miranda, Nicole Lewis as Maya, and Kevin R. Free as Carl, with additional narration by Hank Green as Randall Bolt, Robert Petkoff as Peter Petrowicki, Angelo DiLoretto as Blake Wolf, Oliver Wyman as Adam DiCostanzo, Hilary Huber as Lindsay McAllis, and PJ Oakland as Stephen Jacobs. News articles and tweets read by Gabra Zachman. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer Diane McKiernan. Edited by Jake Nomura Weingrow. Text copyright 2020 by Hank Green. Production copyright 2020 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.